It's 10 after 4 in the morning and I just woke up because I finally figured it out. 44 years old, in my sleep, I figured it out. They called him Sundown because he was dim, not very bright. I could never figure out why they called him Sundown. I was 6 years old and we lived at 404 Grandview Boulevard in Muskogee, Oklahoma, where Mrs. Hamilton was my first grade teacher and I played with R.G. Wilton on the playground during recess and I got in two fights with Dan Beck and won them both by getting him in a chokehold until snot came out his nose. President Kennedy had been assassinated the previous year when we lived in Beaumont. That's how I can always remember the year when a thing happened. All I have to do is remember the house or the town or the school because we moved every year except for Muskogee where we lived for 2 years. His real name was Dwayne, and he was in his early 20s, I guess, and I was a little bit afraid of him. You could tell that he was always trying to fit in with my dad and Al Pinkerton and Ron, the manager from Sears, who never once saw me, but who had the foofy little poodle who was trained to go and sit wherever he pointed his ink pen. I remember Ophelia Pinkerton, who was my sister's age and more than a little overweight, and how she dialed the adjustment on the bathroom scales backwards by 15 pounds when her mom promised her those expensive new boots if she would lose some weight. Ophelia had to cut the boot tops off just above the ankles because her legs were too fat to fit inside. I remember the teenage girl who pulled out her guitar in the clubhouse of the Muskogee Roundup Club and sang "In Them Old Cotton Fields Back Home" so badly that I was embarrassed for her, but now I realize that country music is supposed to be sung like that. To call it a clubhouse was a laugh. It was really just a filthy old one-bedroom house that was on the farm where they built the arena for the Muskogee Roundup Club, which is where I jumped down into the hole they had dug for the footings of the new grandstands and didn't see the rebar sticking up from the ground. I still have the scar on my knee. I guess that's why I'm so angry about the misspelling I noticed 4 days ago on the Oklahoma State University sign at Hills Cafe. Redneck Central for every posing rodeo circuit four-wheel drive tobacco-chewing moron in the area. I mean, even though it was just some pompous thing from the athletics department, it still represents a major university, and that doesn't speak too well of higher education. But then nobody ever said that OSU was good for much besides veterinary medicine, and maybe those guys don't need to spell right anyway. The power and the glory of the Oklahoma State University Athletics Department will never be entrusted to the meek or timid. Aside from being a stupid, pretentious, and redneck thing to say, everyone knows that entrusted isn't spelled with an I, unless you're a good football player, I guess. Then you can spell it any way you want, and they'll give you a passing grade and a degree and pay your tuition, too. I never liked cowboys or athletes, but I always felt bad for Dwayne, because he wasn't stupid due to misplaced priorities like a redneck or a jock. He was physically stupid. Organically, I mean. Like he had a high fever when he was a baby or something. I can't remember Dwayne's last name. I'm not certain I ever knew it. I also don't remember the name of the gritty caretaker at the Muskogee Roundup Club, but he had a boy who was a couple years older than me who didn't go to school. They let Mr. Gritty and his wife and son live in the clubhouse as payment for being the caretakers, I guess. Anyway, we didn't use it as a clubhouse anymore. Once he and my dad and me all squeezed into the cab of his truck, which didn't have any interior except that he had pasted nude centerfolds from magazines all over the inside. I looked down through a hole that was rusted in the floorboard and saw the road going by, and when we drove through the pasture, the tall grass would stick up through the hole. There was also one of those curved-to-fit-your-butt glass bottles with some whiskey in it, and I wondered a little why he didn't seem to be worried that it might fall out. His wife was prettier than you would expect, considering how bad his teeth were and how he smelled. My dad sold the caretaker my Shetland pony, Dink, without asking me if it would be okay or even telling me that he had done it. The first I heard about it was from the caretaker's son, who now owned Dink and could ride him any time he wanted. It's kind of tough when you learn from another kid that your pony isn't yours anymore, but my dad had decided that it was time for me to start riding full-size horses and become a rodeo man roping calves and all, like Jim Shoulders, the world champion all-around cowboy that no one would shut up about. The only cowboy I ever liked was an old man named Dan Bradley who owned Leo Tag, the most famous stud horse in the world. Leo Tag's sire was Leo, and his dam was Tagalong, and that's how he got his name, and he was the most valuable quarter horse in the world, worth $225,000 because it cost $1,000 just to breed your mare to him. Dan Bradley kept Leo Tag in a fancy metal barn big enough to have an indoor arena with several dozen stalls for horses all around it, and even though he was incredibly rich, he took the time to show me how to get the kinks out of my calf rope, and when I asked him if I could buy Leo Tag, he didn't ignore me or laugh or even smile like I was cute or something. "How much can you pay?" is all he asked me, just like I was a grown man. I got scared because now everyone was looking at me and it was real quiet and my throat got tight and tears leaked out the corners of my eyes, but Dan Bradley acted like he didn't see. "I can pay you a quarter a week until he's paid for." Dan Bradley looked right at me and said, "I don't want to sell Leo Tag right now, but I will promise you that if I ever do sell him, it'll be to you." And then he shook my hand and we went on with our calf roping lesson, and then later when all the grown-ups went out to the barn to see Leo Tag in his fancy white leggings and green jacket like he was a Kentucky Derby horse or something, Dan Bradley got everyone's attention and said that it had been more than 10 years since anyone had ridden Leo Tag, but that today he was going to let me ride him and become known as the last man ever to ride Leo Tag. And then he told everyone that if Leo Tag was ever sold, it would be to me, and that we had the deal all worked out. Since he was a stallion, they didn't put a saddle on him or put a bit in his mouth, but Dan Bradley just lifted me up and sat me on top and led me around the indoor arena with a halter. Dan Bradley's son was Dirk Bradley, the world champion calf roper. But Dirk didn't ride bulls and all, so he never became world champion all-around cowboy like Jim Shoulders, who everyone won't shut up about. The only person who could compete with Mr. Gritty for the World Champion All-Around Gritty Award was Shinny of Shinny's Gas Station, where we always bought gas. They say Shinny jimmied his gas pumps so that he could put 21 gallons into an 18-gallon tank, but other than Shinny of Shinny's Gas Station, there was really no competition. Another thing about Al Pinkerton is that he was dapper, even though he was portly, which means overweight. And he wore his cowboy hat cocked to one side and pulled down low over one eye, which I could never do and make it look right. I can't remember which eye. Al Pinkerton also made more money than most people do, so Ophelia could cut the tops off of expensive boots, and Mrs. Pinkerton could wear fancy makeup and go to the hairdresser all the time and drive a brand new Chrysler with a very unusual back glass. It could roll down. I don't mean a back window like in a back door or anything, but the actual back glass, which is opposite the windshield. And it was even electric, which means that Al Pinkerton could roll it down any time he wanted, even if he was driving. The only other Al I know is Al Allnut, who married my grandmother Evelyn for a little while after my grandfather died before I was born, but we don't talk about him. Sometimes when the weather was too bad for my dad to make me ride horses, I could go and play with other kids at their houses and do the things that they do. Tom Borman was my age, and his brother Steve was the age of my sister, and I think maybe he liked her, but she never came over with me because she had her own friend, Leela Horn. Both Bormans were good in sports, especially baseball, and their dad worked for the Chevy dealer, and every night he would come home in a brand new car, sometimes even an SS-396. If Tom Borman told me once, he told me 1,000 times, that his dad took him 100 miles an hour in the SS-396, and it was just like world champion all-around cowboy Jim Shoulders that everyone won't shut up about. One thing about the Bormans is that their front teeth stuck out a little bit, especially Steve, but they let me ride their bikes, which are real Schwinns, which everyone knows are the best. When the Bormans' mom and dad weren't home, they would get out their .22 caliber rifles, which they were never supposed to touch unless their parents were home, and sometimes they would even load bullets in them and all, but they never pointed them at me or anything, because everyone knows you can go to jail for that, even Dwayne. Another thing you can go to jail for is letting a minor have beer, but Mr. Borman kept a whole keg of beer in their refrigerator with a tap on it so that all you had to do was turn it sideways and beer would come out even if you were underage. Sometimes after Tom and Steve would load their rifles, they would get a glass of beer and drink it, because you can't tell how much beer's missing from things that are made of aluminum. The same year that Mr. Borman brought home the SS-396 was the year my dad traded our 56 Chevy, which my mom loved, for a 54 International pickup, which didn't run, but Dad said we needed a truck to pull the horse trailer. We didn't have a horse trailer, but I helped him put a new starter on it, and then it ran sometimes, and we put stock racks on the back, but you can't get a horse to step up that high. So we never actually hauled horses in it, but I liked the stock racks anyway. Sometimes I would stand on the bottom board right behind the cab and hang on to the top board while my dad was driving, and I looked like General Douglas MacArthur or something. The Bormans' house was between our house and the Muskogee Roundup Club, but the Bormans were never looking. My dad didn't tell my mom that he was taking away the car she loved, but he's like that sometimes. He'll even give away your pony to another kid and then let you find out about it. Another thing that happened that year was that Colin, who lived across the street and who was 1 year older than me, burned down the Lutheran church by breaking in and stuffing the songbooks into the piano and then setting it all on fire. I forget the name of his friend who helped him, but Colin's dad was a Marine, and there was a lot of trouble over it, and they moved away after that. On the other side of me was a boy my age who was always throwing asphalt chunks at us that he picked up from the edge of the street, but he wasn't as good a thrower as Steve Borman, who played baseball, so one day, when he raised up from behind his fort, Steve threw an asphalt chunk sidearm and hit him just above his eyebrow. Blood was everywhere, and the kid was screaming, and I think there was some trouble between the parents, but the kid never threw asphalt after that. His dad had a ham radio, though, and it was always messing up our television reception, until one day he was lying on the sofa and just died of a heart attack or something. When my parents told me about it at dinner, I said, "Well, at least he won't be messing up our television signal," which was completely true and all, but they said I shouldn't have said it and shouldn't feel that way. I'm not saying that Colin should have burned down the church or anything, but everyone knows that if God had wanted pianos in the church, he would have said so in the Bible, which is why it was interesting that Colin started the fire in the piano just like he was an angel of God or something. It even says in Revelation that, "Thou shalt be cursed with a curse if thou addest even one jot or one tittle to all that is written herein." And everyone knows that a piano is much bigger than a jot or tittle. At least you know that if you're Church of Christ, which we were. The people who moved into the house where Colin lived were the exact opposite of him, but they didn't live there very long, and I can't remember the boy's name who was my age. But I do remember that on the day they moved away, he went to each house where he had a friend, and he asked the friend to come over, and then he made a big presentation out of giving him one of his toys while his mother stood there watching. Not just some little toy either, but one of his very best ones. He gave me his air rifle, which was almost brand new because he knew I liked it. It was sort of a tender moment and all, and it bothers me a lot that I can't remember his name, but they didn't really live there very long. I think they were Mormon or something. It was at the end of the second grade, just before we moved to Skytook, that we had a big outdoor program with lights and everything on the lawn of Hilldale Elementary where I went to school and Mrs. Shelton was my second grade teacher. We did exercises while a record player played "Go You Chicken Fat Go" over the loudspeakers, and all the parents were there watching except for my dad, who was off with my sister at a rodeo competition where she was trying to win points so that she could become Oklahoma Junior Rodeo Association state champion 12 and under. But my mom came, so it's really just the same, I guess. My sister was a better rider than me, partly because she's 3.5 years older, and the exact same horses would run a few tenths of a second faster for her than for me in barrel racing and flag racing and pole bending and all. So she won blue ribbons and trophies, and the hand-tooled Billy Cook roping saddle with OJRA state champion 12 and under stamped on the stirrups, and all I got was a whole tennis shoe box full of second-place ribbons, which are usually red. It says in the Bible that God speaks with a still small voice sometimes, like when after Elijah killed the 400 prophets of Baal by calling down fire from heaven to burn up the offering on Mount Carmel, and then he went to hide in a cave in the mountains. It says there was an earthquake, but that God was not in the earthquake. And then there was a mighty wind, but God was not in the wind. And then there was a fire, but God was not in the fire. Then Elijah heard a tiny voice and covered his face and walked out of the cave, and God said, "Elijah, what are you doing here?" I think God spoke in a tiny voice like that in the Lutheran church, but I would never say that. Because if I did, it would probably be just like the time I said we wouldn't have to worry about our television reception anymore. It's in the 18th and 19th chapter of the book of 1 Kings, if you don't believe me. One more thing about Dwayne. Like most people who are not very bright, he was also extremely strong. I think God gives them that so they won't get pushed around so bad by people who are smarter than them. It's that tiny voice of God again, I think. The worst thing Dwayne ever did is that he robbed a liquor store and got thrown in jail for it until the judge realized that he wasn't smart enough to rob a liquor store and let him go. My mom read about it in the newspaper because I think she knew Dwayne's last name. Dwayne could probably spell if he wanted to, maybe even win a spelling bee. At least good enough to beat the jocks at the Oklahoma State University Athletics Department who can't even spell "in trust." The worst thing about moving to Skytook is that I had to be the new kid again. No way out of it. But Tommy lived across the street and to the left, and he was okay, I guess. But Damon lived across the street and to the right, and he wasn't. As soon as I heard his name, I knew it fit him, because Damon should have been spelled D-A-E-M-O-N. Which is an overseas way of spelling demon, like the ones Jesus cast into a herd of swine in the region of the Gadarenes in the book of Matthew. Luke tells the same story, except that he spells it Gerasenes. But he might have gone to Oklahoma State University or something. Third grade in Skytook is where I can't even remember my teacher's face or name, which is another way of saying that it was not my best year, so I was glad when we moved to Broken Arrow where Mrs. Fischler was my teacher. Tommy across the street and to the left was okay, but maybe a little bit too much of a jock and all. When the Ford dealer on Main Street sponsored the punt, pass, and kick competition, Tommy won the gold medal, which is probably just as big as the ones they give at the Olympics. I would have done better, except that I tried too hard on the kicking part, which is usually my best skill. My foot hit the top of the ball, so that it just tumbled off the tee and went exactly 4 feet 7 inches. And I was glad that the people measuring didn't laugh or anything. Damon from across the street and to the right would have laughed for sure, but he wasn't there because he knew he didn't stand a chance against Tommy. The best thing about Skytook is that there's an old drugstore on Main Street just 5 blocks from our house that had a soda fountain where you could get a salty dog for a nickel, which is just crushed ice covered in lime juice and salt. They also sold these little bottles of cinnamon oil, which were just the right size to stick toothpicks in to make cinnamon toothpicks, which is what my sister did all the time. I don't want to talk about the Skytook Roundup Club. Another thing about Skytook is that's the year we had to go visit my Aunt Molly, who got sent to reform school. Molly had a boyfriend in Guthrie named Cody Luntz, who my mom thinks is sort of responsible for my grandmother deciding to kill herself. It was some kind of drug deal or something, but Cody Luntz shot a shotgun from a moving vehicle, which is a felony, even if you aren't pointing the gun at someone, which Cody Luntz was. He went to prison, and my Aunt Molly went to reform school because she was underage to go to prison or even drink beer, which I also know she did. Molly's reform school was Catholic, but that didn't really matter because Molly wasn't anything, especially not Church of Christ. Once, when we visited Molly on a Sunday, she sang some rock and roll religious songs with all of Cody Luntz's other girlfriends in the chapel at the Reform School, which was surrounded by a high chain-link fence with razor wire on top. They had a piano and an organ, like the Lutheran Church in Muskogee, but we've already talked about that. When Molly got out of Reform School, I didn't see her again until the summer I went to work for my granddad, who spent his whole life running an ice delivery service in Guthrie. You know those bags of crushed ice at all the gas stations and convenience stores and bait shops and all? My grandfather would buy 300-pound blocks of ice at the ice plant and then haul it to one of his crushing sites, which is really just a gigantic walk-in freezer somewhere, and then crush the ice and bag it and take it to those little freezers at the gas stations and convenience stores and bait shops and all, which he owns. The freezers, I mean. He would keep those freezers filled with crushed ice, and the convenience stores would pay us in cash from the cash register and then sell the ice for more than they paid us for it. That's what my grandfather did for more than 50 years, starting when he was just 9 years old. It was a very good business. Even when he was old, my grandfather could reach out with one hand and snag a 300-pound block of ice with a pair of tongs and swing it up on his back as he walked past it without even breaking stride. I've seen him do it. He was maybe even stronger than Dwayne. I lived with my granddad in his house, which Molly also lived in, but at night, when both of them were gone, I just watched TV. By this time, Molly was about 24, but not yet married to Cody Luntz, who was still in prison. We sacked ice together every day, but she was not what you would call a pleasant person, until finally we got into a fight with ice hooks and ice picks, and that's when my mom drove 4 hours from Broken Arrow to pick me up and bring me home. She never spoke to her father or to her sister Molly again, which was really sad because grandmother had killed herself just 2 years earlier, and I figured granddad was sad enough already. But then he married Phyllis from down the street, who he was dating when I worked for him sacking ice. Mom thinks they might have been dating even longer. Mom is extremely pretty and elegant, like Audrey Hepburn in Roman Holiday and Breakfast at Tiffany's. And even though she got pregnant and dropped out of school when she was just 16, she's still one of the world's smartest people. She even took the IQ test and was immediately accepted into Mensa, where they give you a funny little hat pin with a yellow plastic head to wear in your hair or your clothes so that other geniuses will know that you're smart like they are. When Cody Luntz got out of prison, he married my Aunt Molly. Did I mention she is redheaded? They were married a few years, and then Cody went to sleep with a cold one night and never woke up. Molly woke up in bed next to a dead man. But since my mom, who was smart, thinks that maybe Cody and Molly had something to do with my grandmother killing herself, I think that a person might be able to listen real close and hear the tiny voice of God, but I would never say that. My dad has good handwriting, and my mom can spell any word. They call it the Palmer method. The handwriting, I mean. We didn't go to the Church of Christ in Skytook, but went instead to the Church of Christ in Collinsville, which is 14 miles away. I don't know why. Altogether, I had 8 years perfect attendance without ever missing a service, which means Sunday morning, Sunday night, and Wednesday night. Forsake not the assembling of yourselves together as the manner of some is, but exhort one another so much the more as you see the day approaching. You'll find that verse in the 10th chapter of the book of Hebrews in the New Testament, which anyone can tell you who is Church of Christ. And the day approaching is definitely Wednesday night, because that's how you can really tell the depth of a person's commitment. Halfway between our house and the school was a large field of grass which burned completely, and I picked up over $1 worth of pop bottles which I cashed at the grocery store next to the Ford dealer that gave Tommy the gold medal for punt, pass, and kick. The store gave me back the deposits for all the bottles, even the ones that were old, and the ones the fire burned black. I don't know how it started. We moved from our first house in Skytook that was near Main Street to another one in Skytook that was out in the country, but I didn't have to change schools or anything because there was only one. That's where we got Pearl and Kay. They had been abandoned or something because they were living on June bugs that were attracted to the security light that was on the pole behind the house, even though no one lived in it. Kay looked exactly like Lassie. And Pearl was part beagle, part cocker spaniel, and probably part wiener dog, which is also called dachshund. She weighed exactly 17 pounds, because I would stand on the scales and weigh myself, and then stand on the scales holding Pearl, and the difference between the two numbers was how much Pearl weighed. I got the idea for doing that from reading about Archimedes, and how he used the displacement of water in his bathtub for determining the mass of irregular objects. Pearl and me on those scales wasn't exactly the same thing, but it's sort of the same, so I'm sure you get the idea. Out in the country, there are no other houses, so Tommy couldn't live across the street and to the left anymore. Mom called her Pitiful Pearl, and she was the smartest and best friend I ever had. Ever. One thing you better not do was act like you were going to hit me or anything, even if you were my dad, because Pearl would act like she was going to bite you no matter who you were. Nobody ever decided to see if she would really bite them, though. Most people saw that she wasn't bluffing or joking and just decided that maybe it wasn't such a smart idea to yell at me or act mad or anything. Once my dad was having a bad day and Pearl was near his feet, so he kicked her and she flew off the ground and landed about 5 feet away, so I tried to kill him. But I wasn't big enough and Pearl wasn't really hurt, so we just ran away. Do you want me to tell you what I did in third grade that I never told anyone about? I went in my room and closed the door and prayed to God, and I remember exactly what I said. I did it because my sister and I never really got along, to say the least, and Pearl was the smartest dog to ever live, and she was my very best friend. When I was sad, she would act all sad and lick my cheek and look up in my face, and then if I smiled a little, she would wiggle and dance around and act all happy. No one could cheer me up like Pearl. She always slept in my room, and usually when I woke up, she would be in bed with me. I said, God, I know how people are always making promises to you and then breaking them, and how they always try to bargain with you like they actually had something that you needed. So I just want to say up front that I don't have anything to offer in return, and I'm not going to make any promises to you because I would probably just break them anyway, and this is too important to depend on whether or not I can keep up my end of the bargain. So let's not make this about how good I am, but about how good you are, okay? The reason I'm asking you to do this is because you're God and no one else is. And I think that you might be willing to do this for me because I ask you, and without any other reason. So here's what I'm asking. I want you to guard Pearl and keep her from being run over by a car, even if she walks out in front of one, and keep her from getting lost even though we don't have a fence, and don't ever let anyone kill her or give her away or steal her, and make sure that she never gets any diseases or gets in a fight with another dog or any animal that might hurt her. And even though she's already a grown dog, I want you to give her such a long life that she doesn't get old and die until I'm engaged to be married. And when it's time for her to die, I want you to make it absolutely painless and make sure that she doesn't know that she's dying. And make sure you give me 24 hours notice in advance, okay? Because she and I will have a lot to talk about. I don't have a clue how you're going to give me 24 hours notice, but you'll figure something out. After all, you're God, right? And as long as we're being honest here, I just want to say that I'm not going to pray this prayer over and over and over like you didn't hear me the first time. I know that you're listening, and I know that you can do this for me if you want. In Jesus' name, amen. Then I got up and walked outside and never prayed that prayer again. When my dad decided to start selling insurance for MFA, he had to take a test which was about his personality. Later, they gave him a big envelope with a confidential report in it, which was about his personality and all, but it was sealed, and he wasn't supposed to open it at all, but was supposed to give it to the interviewer, which was 2 days from now. He really, really wanted to open that envelope and see what it said about him, but my mom hid it from him until the morning of the interview because she said they probably had a way of telling if you opened it, even if you steamed it open and then resealed it. She figured there probably wasn't even a personality report inside, but that it was just a test of honesty and trustworthiness, and the real test was whether or not you'd open the envelope. Anyway, that's how we got to Broken Arrow, a booming town which did not have an MFA insurance office. Fourth grade was in Broken Arrow, and my teacher was Mrs. Fischler at Southside Elementary. Fifth grade was in Broken Arrow, and my teacher was Mr. McMillan at Haskell Elementary. Sixth grade was in Broken Arrow, and my teacher was Mr. Wolcott at Northeast Elementary. So you can see that we still moved every year, even though we didn't necessarily go to a different town, just to a different school. But by this time, I was getting to be an expert at being the new kid. The secret is not to go out at recess with the other kids, but just to stay in the classroom and read a book. Spelling is easy when you read enough good books. You can just look at a word and immediately know if it's spelled right or not. And good books never have anything in them about dads who give away your pony or favorite grandmothers who kill themselves or anything like that. Our first house in Broken Arrow was at 508 West Pittsburgh, right across Elm Street from the farm where my dad kept all the horses that I had to feed and water before I walked to school every day. It was no big deal, really, except that there was no water in their pasture, so I had to carry 5-gallon buckets of it about 200 yards, which is hard to do when you're in the fourth grade, even if you are big for your age. The secret is to carry 2 5-gallon buckets instead of just one, so they balance each other out and you don't get pulled over to one side. No big thing, really. You don't have to be world champion all-around Cowboy Jim Shoulders or anything like that. You would be surprised how much a horse can drink, though. One day I spotted a quarter in the dust near the gate, except that this quarter was actually underground. I'm not saying that I have X-ray vision or anything like that. Not even Twain believes those ads in the backs of comic books about X-ray glasses that cost $2 and let you see through a girl's clothes. It's just that the dust near the gate was as fine as talcum powder, and even though there was at least an eighth of an inch of it on top of the quarter, I could still see a perfect circle in the dirt that didn't have any reason to be there and was exactly the diameter of George Washington's head. And this was back in the days when they only gave you 2 cents deposit when you turned in pop bottles and candy bars were just a nickel and Dr. Pepper was a dime. Mrs. Fischler was an extremely good teacher, even though she was very old. The best thing she did was make us lay our heads down on our desks for a little while each day while she read us a chapter from Charlotte's Web. She was also the first teacher ever to tell me that I should become a writer, which I am today. And she understood that some people like to stay in at recess and read books instead of doing things outdoors, even though later that year my best friend became Shane Greeley, who was such a good friend that I asked him to be the best man at my wedding. So I began going outside with Shane during recess and doing most of my reading at night, and that was okay with Mrs. Fischler, too. She didn't bug you to go outside if you didn't want to. Shane Greeley and I read a lot of the same books in elementary school, and when we were old enough to drive, we listened to a lot of the same music, even though our taste was very different in girls. Shane only lived 2 blocks away, so when I didn't have to ride horses at the Broken Arrow Roundup Club, I could run to his house and we could play spies or make paper airplanes or float boats made from scrap lumber in the St. Lawrence Seaway, which was the creek that ran next to my house. We called it that because it was shaped exactly like the St. Lawrence Seaway, which we studied during geography in Mrs. Fischler's class. I could take you there and show you if you wanted to see it, but most people don't. Shane Greeley and I stayed friends even after my dad moved us so far out on 101st Street that our house was past the Boy Scout camp that no one swims at because it's too far away. That's true friendship. One thing that Shane Greeley and I did together in the fourth grade was play Cahoolies. Probably no one else in the world ever played Cahoolies, because they wouldn't have thought of it like we did. I remember specifically that it was in the fourth grade instead of another grade because it was in the bathroom of the house at 508 West Pittsburgh, which also had the St. Lawrence Seaway. That was a good house. To play Cahoolies, first you have to read the Dig Allen book, Trappers of Venus, where Dig Allen goes to Venus, whose atmosphere is very hot and steamy. The house at 508 West Pittsburgh had one of those gas heaters built into the wall that could be adjusted so that you could make it extremely hot and steamy like Venus, especially if you turned on the shower in the bathtub as hot as it would go. I forget the rest of the rules for playing Cahoolies, but that's the main one. The rest of the Dig Allen books were called The Forgotten Star, Captives in Space, Journey to Jupiter, Robots of Saturn, and Lost City of Uranus. Dig Allen was also redheaded, but he wasn't like my Aunt Molly at all. Another thing which made the house on Pittsburgh a good house was that it was across the street from the farm where we kept our horses, which means that there were no houses on that side of Elm Street. Only a row of pine trees next to the road that Shane Greeley and I would make snowballs behind and loft them over the pine trees with perfect timing so that they would land on the windshields of cars that were driving down Elm. I was better at this than you might think, even though I didn't play Little League for the Bankers like Shane Greeley, which everyone knows is the best team. Those were the days, all right, but only when it was snowing. Those days and rainy days were the only ones where you didn't have to go to the Broken Arrow Roundup Club and ride horses with a bunch of people who never heard of Dig Allen or anything, but only want to talk about you-know-who that everyone won't shut up about. Fourth grade was a very rainy and snowy year. Martin Luther King was assassinated during the spring by a redneck with three first names. It happened on a Thursday. I don't know why I remember that. The pine trees that Shane Greeley and I used to hide behind are all gone now, because that farm was made into a housing addition where no one finds quarters anymore. Right where that gate was is probably someone's living room or something. Did I already say that my dad bought 30 acres out past Boy Scout Camp Russell? That was fifth grade, Mr. McMillan, Haskell Elementary. It was also the only year that I ever had to ride bus 14, and our house was the very first stop on the bus route, so I could always get the back seat and save it to share with Bo Todd, who also rode bus 14. Being the first house means that I had to get up earlier than any of the other kids and sit there for the whole bus route, which was very long, because you'd be surprised how many kids you can get into one of those school buses. The main difference between Bo Todd and me, aside from the fact that he was sixth grade and I was only fifth, is that he was an actual farm kid. So all that stuff about castrating horses and cows and pigs and all didn't bother him a bit. He thought it was perfectly normal. The good news is that being first on the bus route in the morning means that you're also the first one they let off the bus after school, so you can play with your dog Pearl, who waits for you asleep on the front porch until she hears the doors open on bus 14, and then starts running around the yard and showing off. We didn't have Kay anymore. One day, I got off the bus and saw that our car was in the driveway, which it never was when the bus dropped us off because my dad had to drive it to work and all. It gave me a very bad feeling, which I knew was correct, when I saw my mom's face and my dad's face when my sister and I walked into the living room. I started crying when they told us to sit down because somehow I knew what was coming. Grown-ups think that 11-year-olds can't figure things out, and don't know what you're talking about when you make veiled comments about your secretary Leanne to some of your employees at Club America. And yes, even a fifth grader is smart enough to figure out that Club America, which is supposed to sell memberships for discounts on meals at fine restaurants and entertainment events and all, had scam written all over it, and those men who worked for you were just oily posers who looked up to you because you were 32 and they were 25 or something, and Leanne was only 20, which was just 6 years older than my sister. You can figure out a lot of things when you're 11. In the Church of Christ, we didn't miss a church service for 8 years, and then when we quit going, Leonard Petty came over and said he was concerned about our souls and about eternal darkness and all. But Mom said to pay no attention to him, since no one from the church ever came to visit us after my dad disappeared with that girl Leanne, even though they all knew that her and my sister and me didn't have any money even for food, and that was 2 years ago, and where was all their concern then? No one cared about us or worried about us as long as we were sitting in those pews 3 times a week and had perfect attendance. At least that's what my mom said. For 2 whole years after my dad disappeared, we continued to show up 3 times a week, and no one in the Church of Christ cared that my mom didn't have a high school diploma and didn't have a job and didn't have any money to buy food or pay utilities, but all she had was 2 kids, and one of them wanted to be in band. That scene with Leonard Petty and all happened in the 7th grade, at 1943 South Lyons, which was 2 whole houses later. I'm sorry for skipping ahead 2 years. I'll try to get back on track. Do you want me to go back and tell you about Beaumont, Texas, where we lived when I was 5 years old, back before we moved to Muskogee and met Al Pinkerton and Duane and started buying horses that everyone hates to ride? In Beaumont, my best friend's name was Brett Mackey, which is funny, because my dad's 7th wife was a Mackey before he married her, but she was not from the same family of Mackeys as my friend Brett Mackey. My mom was wife number one, and they were married for 16 years, and his only kids are my sister and me. Mom never remarried, but Dad did 3 more times after the Mackey woman, which makes 10 in all, but he says that there weren't nearly that many, but there were, and I met every one of them and can name them in perfect order. After my mom was Leanne, then Charlene, Diane, Naomi, Leslie, Sissy, Donna, and then one whose name I can't remember right now, and then Eddie. My dad is the oldest son of a Church of Christ minister who died when my dad was 14. My sister was born 2 years later. Yes, Eddie was a woman. It's just that her name was Eddie, that's all. My dad may have his faults, but that's definitely not one of them. Anyway, Beaumont is about 1 hour north of Houston on the Gulf of Mexico if you're driving a car. Beaumont means beautiful mountain in French, which is funny because there isn't a mountain or even a hill for 150 miles in any direction, especially east, which is the ocean. In Beaumont, it rains so hard that the streets would fill up with water all the way to the top of the curb, and when you're 5 years old, you can float boats that you made from scraps of lumber until they go down the storm drain, never to be seen again unless they show up in China or something. And at night, the mosquitoes are so thick around the street lights that a special truck will come and blow insecticide fog up by them with a special tube about as big as the heat and air conditioning ducts in your attic. The people who lived between us and Brett Mackey had three kids named Carrie and Cash and Betts, who was a girl and completely covered with giant freckles from her head to her toes, almost like a Dalmatian. I know this for certain, because one day she was getting spanked and was screaming so loud that everyone in the neighborhood was wondering what was happening. Then the front door of her house burst open, and Betts came running out completely naked with her mother right behind her except with her clothes on. Carrie was my age, and Betts was my sister's age, and Cash was in between, but we didn't hardly ever play with them because Cash and Carrie were always trying to get me to do homosexual things with them, which of course I never did. Even Dwayne is too smart for some of the tricks that Cash and Carrie would try to pull. Brett Mackey was a little bit like the Bormans in that he owned .22 caliber bullets that he was never supposed to touch but did anyway. The whole problem with Cash and Carrie got easier to handle when Carrie took one of Brett's bullets and put it on the floor of the garage at Brett's house and then started hitting it with a hammer to see if he could make it fire. Mr. Mackey walked into the garage and saw what was happening and said the bullet could have gone off and shot through the garage wall into the kitchen and killed Brett's mom, who was making macaroni and cheese. So it wasn't much of a problem avoiding Cash and Carrie after that. The bullet never did fire, but it could have, and nobody's mom deserves to be shot while making dinner for her family. I have to admit, though, that I was amazed at how flat you can smash a .22 caliber bullet without it ever firing. After we moved away from the 30 acres that my dad had bought for the horses, it was time for fifth grade to be over, and my mom and my sister and me moved into an apartment behind a convenience store that was right across the street from the Church of Christ, which everyone knows is on 71st Street. The Munn family was also Church of Christ, and Roger Munn was my age, and his little brother was Mickey. Strange thing about the Munn family is that Mr. Munn thought it was important for everyone to know that his boys weren't hippies, so he would oil their heads down with Vitalis and combed their hair with a precision straight part, which was made even worse by the fact that their hair was black. To be honest, it made them look like a family of ducks. The three of them, including Mr. Munn, looked like they were all the same person, except in three different sizes. Once I spent the night at Roger Munn's house, so I could watch Neil Armstrong land on the moon on their TV, and the next morning I was told to line up with Roger and Mickey so that Mr. Munn could oil my head down with Vitalis. He opened the bathroom pantry and pulled out a giant economy-sized bottle of hair oil. That would have been scary enough if there weren't 24 identical bottles behind it, which there were. It may have been the scariest moment of my life. We only lived in the apartment behind the convenience store for one summer, because my mom was able to get a job as a filing clerk, and then we moved to 603 North Ash, which is where I lived during sixth grade, and went to Northeast Elementary in the old part of town. It was a strange year, and there were lots of tornadoes. You're not going to believe me, but the person that I spent the most time with in the sixth grade at Northeast Elementary was named Tommy Rohde. First, there was Tom Borman in Muskogee, and then there was Tommy and Skytuke across the street and to the left, and now another kid named Tommy? It was just a coincidence, though. Tommy Rohde's dad was a highway patrolman, but I never once met him, even though I was over there all the time. Tommy Rohde had a brother named Andy Rohde, who was the same age as my sister, but you definitely don't want to hear about him. Shane Greeley was still going to Southside Elementary like both of us did in the fourth grade. He didn't ever go to Haskell Elementary or Northeast Elementary like I did. Roger Munn went to Oakcrest. Sixth grade was the year that I started mowing other people's lawns for money and building go-karts and mini-bikes from old side-shaft lawnmower engines, and the lady that we shared a back fence with who was always in her garden gave me a box of books which included all the Tom Corbett Space Cadet series, which is even better than Dig Allen, if you can believe it. Tom Corbett is another Tom, which is also just a coincidence. Tom Corbett's friends were Roger Manning, who was kind of sarcastic, and Astro, who was a natural-born rocket mechanic. He didn't have a last name, though, just Astro. One of the things that we did a lot when I was in the sixth grade was have dinner at Jed and Cheryl Kingsley's house, who was my mom's lawyer. I think they probably asked us to come to their house a lot because they knew we didn't have any money, but I'm only guessing. They never said that or anything. The best thing about going to Jed and Cheryl Kingsley's house is that Benny and Dexter were usually there, and they were in high school and college, but not at Oklahoma State University. Benny and Dexter would wrestle with me and take me with them when they went places. One of the things that Benny did when he wasn't in medical school was work on his Ford GT40, which looked exactly like a real one, except this one had a Porsche engine on a Volkswagen frame. If it wasn't for that, you would have thought it was a real Ford GT40, which everyone knows is the most beautiful car ever made, even if it wasn't painted yet. They called it a GT40 because the roof was only 40 inches off the ground, and the reason Ford built it was because they had been in negotiations with Enzo Ferrari to buy his company, and then he backed out at the last minute, so they designed a car to kick his butt. Sometimes he would take me riding in it, even though it wasn't finished or legal or anything, and we would go right down Main Street and honk the horn. At least that's what Benny said, and he should know. Benny's brother Dexter drove a green Karmann Ghia, and that's not the only way he was different from Benny either. Dexter was loud and smiled a lot and had a dark suntan and big muscles and curly hair and a girlfriend named Pam, which Benny didn't have any of. But Benny had glasses and Dexter didn't, so I guess it was really pretty equal. Dexter worked for the City of Broken Arrow, where he rode on the back of a garbage truck and grabbed people's garbage cans and dumped them in until it was full. One day something happened which was very sad and made Dexter quit working for the City of Broken Arrow and begin working for Quick Trip, which is a convenience store. A little boy was following real close, right behind the garbage truck on his bicycle, and when it stopped and began backing up, he fell down and the truck ran over his head and he died, and guess who found him then? I don't know who picks up the garbage now. Sometimes Benny would invite me into his room, even though I was only 11, and listen to the Moody Blues and Grand Funk Railroad on his stereo. One time, Benny's mom, Cheryl, was telling my mom that the saddest day she could ever remember was when Benny was 11 like me, but Cheryl didn't know that I could hear her talking from the other room. Benny wasn't there that day. She said that they sent out invitations to all of the kids in Benny's class at school for them to come over to Benny's birthday party. And Benny sat on top of the gatepost in the front yard and waited for the other kids to show up, but none of them ever did. Sometimes Benny would act frustrated and a little bit angry, but not at me or anything, just in general. But that wasn't all the time. Mostly Benny was pretty happy. About 4 years later, when Benny was getting out of medical school, he got married and his wife had a baby about 4.5 months later, and Benny said, "You know how to make babies faster when you're a doctor," but I think he was making it up. I never did tell Benny that I knew about the birthday party because he probably just would have been embarrassed, and who needs that? One more thing. Benny and Dexter never talked about horses at all, and I don't think they ever even heard of world champion all-around cowboy Jim Shoulders that nobody cares about. One person I forgot to tell you about is Henrietta and Leo Wyatt. It was during the summer after sixth grade, when all the kids were going to Burnt Cabin summer camp, that they asked my mother if they could pay to send my sister and me to camp with the other kids. It cost $15 for 2 weeks for each kid. I wanted to go, but my sister didn't, because she was 3.5 years older than me and people her age didn't go to Burnt Cabin summer camp so much. I won't even try to tell you what a great time I had, but when I was older and started making a lot of money, I sent Henrietta and Leon Wyatt a $100 bouquet of flowers just to say thank you. Do you know how big that is? And any time I hear about kids whose moms don't have money to send them to camp, I always pay it for them in honor of Henrietta and Leon Wyatt, who never had kids of their own. Did you know that recall cues are something that everybody has, but most people don't know that they have them? One of my recall cues is the movie True Grit, starring John Wayne. Or even just the name of the movie, or a picture of him wearing an eye patch. The movie is about a 14-year-old girl whose father has been murdered, and she hires John Wayne, who is a fat and cranky one-eyed U.S. Marshal, to help her track him down. The murderer's name is Tom Chaney, and the girl's name is Maddie Ross, but in real life it's Kim Darby. My dad took my sister and me to that movie at the movie theater, and then I didn't see him or talk to him again for 6 years. Glenn Campbell was in it, too. Every day during her lunch hour, my mom would drive to a better place to work and fill out a job application. She said that sooner or later she would get hired either at American Airlines or Shell Oil Company, both of which were good places to work but for different reasons. Shell Oil Company finally hired her at their credit card center in Tulsa, and since it was non-union, she could get promoted faster than if it was all done by seniority. This good job allowed us to get an FHA 221-D2 loan, for a brand new house at 1943 South Lyons for $15,000, except that my mom asked the builder to build a brick flower bed in front of ours so that it would look different from the other houses on our street, and that made it $15,100. At the end of the summer, I started 7th grade at Sequoia Junior High, and things began to get a lot better. The only sad thing was that Shane Greeley was at Central Junior High, not Sequoia Junior High, but nothing could be done about it. I went there for all 3 years, 7th grade, 8th grade, and 9th grade, and boy do I have stories to tell you about that. In the 7th grade, you have a different teacher every hour, so you really don't have just one teacher anymore. And then, at the end of the day, you go to athletics and let goofball coaches yell shallow platitudes at you. Or maybe it's different where you live. About having a different teacher every hour, I mean. Nothing is quite so sad as a grown man barking at the top of his lungs to a bunch of big-eyed adolescents, "If you succeed in football, you'll succeed in life." And did you ever meet a coach who didn't believe in giving 110%? I think that's why they never let coaches teach math class. A.E. Housman wrote a 7-stanza poem called To an Athlete Dying Young, in which he suggests that it's smart to die young if you're a star athlete, because you're never going to receive that kind of hero worship again. I remember a little bit of how it goes. The time you won your town the race, we cheered you through the marketplace. Man and boy stood cheering by, and home we brought you shoulder high. Today the road all runners come, shoulder high we bring you home, and set you at your threshold down, townsman of a stiller town. Smart lad, to slip betimes away from fields where glory does not stay. Eyes the shady night has shut cannot see the record cut. Now you will not swell the rout of lads that wore their honors out, runners whom renown outran, and the name died before the man. It was in the 7th grade that I figured out that while there were lots of coaches who are teachers, there are very few teachers who are coaches. But maybe it's different where you live. Zach Masterson's dad owned a pawn shop, and sometimes he would let me and Zach work for him polishing rings and carrying things into the attic and such. Zach had a brother named Greg, who was in college, and a sister named Alicia, who was the age of my sister, and a baby sister named Jenny, who was in the 1st grade. They were Catholic. I think the Mastersons may have been the first normal family I ever knew. Not only did Mr. and Mrs. Masterson like each other, but all the kids liked each other too. Alicia and Greg were always happy to give us a ride somewhere, and they gave us good advice and did whatever they could to help us out. And Jenny never pestered us or made trouble. Zach had a stereo that his dad had brought home from the pawn shop for him, and we listened to the Beatles and Simon and Garfunkel. He also had his own TV from the pawn shop, too. One night we were watching Mannix when one of the Dugans, I can't remember if it was Don or Jim, suddenly appeared on the screen right in the middle of an episode. It wasn't a commercial break or anything. One of the Dugans was the weatherman, and the other Dugan hosted a fishing show. I can't remember which one it was, but they were both famous TV personalities in Tulsa, which was 14 miles away and had all the TV stations. Anyway, the Dugan was sitting in a cheap kitchen chair on the cement floor of the studio with a stupid grin on his face and his middle finger saluting the cameraman. And then, just as suddenly, he was gone, and we were watching Mannix again, and there was only one Dugan brother after that. Zach Masterson was extremely good at boxing, which is a sport they teach at Subiaco Academy, which is a private boys' school in another state, where his dad and his brother went and which Zach was going to have to start attending in the 9th grade. It looks like a giant medieval castle on a hilltop in rural Arkansas, and it's also an abbey for Benedictine monks. In the summers, they had a 2-week summer camp, and boys would come from all over America. And you didn't just swim in a lake, but in an Olympic pool. And there was a field house and a go-kart track and a boxing ring and every other thing you can think of. Summer camps like that aren't $15 for 2 weeks like Burnt Cabin. They're $90 for 2 weeks, which is about 2/3 of how much our house payment was every month, and my mom's little sister Kathleen had to move in with us to help us pay even that much. But I never told people stuff like that. I didn't want them to think that we were poor or anything. Anyway, one day Zach Masterson's dad brought home a huge amount of stuff from the attic of the pawn shop, which was too out of date to sell there, and had a big garage sale. And then guess who they sent to Subiaco Academy summer camp for 2 weeks with Zach? One day, we helped the monks haul hay from the pasture by loading the bales of hay onto the back of a flatbed truck and then unloading the hay in the barn. It was hot and bright and dusty and golden when we looked up and saw a wall of purple rain coming slowly toward us from the east.
We barely got the hay into the barn before the rain arrived. When it was over, we all piled onto the truck and one of the monks drove us to the drive-in theater, where we saw a vampire movie. Brad from Georgia said, "Well, that ain't nothing but a big old tick." And we all started laughing, and the movie wasn't scary after that. The next day, about 7 of us piled into an old army jeep and went several miles down a dirt road to a swimming place called Blue Hole, because it was so deep. On the way back, I was standing in the jeep holding onto the roll bar, when a low-hanging branch lashed across my chest when I wasn't looking and ripped open the inside of my arm a little. But I didn't let it bother me because I was at summer camp with my friend Zach Masterson. I still have the scar. After my arm quit bleeding, I went to the go-kart time trials, which is where everyone races the same go-kart against each other on an obstacle course set up in one of the parking lots. I came in 2nd, which is pretty good considering there were about 200 guys who tried. On Boxing Day, I boxed the biggest kid in the camp named Larry Schultze, but he wasn't necessarily the best boxer, so I won. Nobody wanted to box Zach Masterson, even when he offered to box with only one hand. We were 13 then. Later that year, my dog had puppies. When it came time to find homes for them, my mom put a classified ad in the newspaper that said, "Authentic Precious Pearl Puppies Free to Good Homes," and then gave our telephone number. When people called to ask what a Precious Pearl puppy was, we would just tell them that they were puppies from our dog Precious Pearl. And then when we told them about Pearl, everyone wanted a puppy. That was when I started to learn about advertising. In his book, Sweet Thursday, John Steinbeck says, "Looking back, you can usually find the moment of the birth of a new era, whereas when it happened, it was just one day hooked on to the tail of another." I think I know exactly what he meant. Another person that Zach and I ran around with a lot was Barry Maxwell, who was actually a year older than us, but his mom held him back in the 2nd grade, so he was in our class. Barry was big like a bull, and he could flare his nostrils like one too, which I've never been able to do. One thing I learned from Barry is never to light a fart. Everyone says that they burn with a blue flame, but no one ever tells you how you're supposed to get the match close enough without burning yourself. And of course, no one ever wants to hold the match, so you have to do it yourself while looking in a mirror, and that just never seems to work out. At least that's what Barry told me, and I have no reason to doubt him. In the 7th grade after football season, you have to choose between wrestling and basketball. Zach and Barry were both in wrestling, but I chose basketball because I was tall and skinny. But since both practices were over at about the same time, we always walked home together. One day after practice, we walked across the street and went behind the church with about 75 other guys because Billy Tucker was supposed to fight Lenny Hardesty. When we got there, Billy was waiting for him, but Lenny hadn't arrived yet. Billy Tucker was one of those guys who was just your average guy, except that he was overweight like Ophelia Pinkerton. Lenny Hardesty, on the other hand, was an interesting character who ran around with a much older crowd. What made Lenny interesting is that he was over 6 feet tall in the 7th grade, but weighed only about 110 pounds, and his shoe size was 16 AAA, which is narrow enough to walk along the top of a picket fence. Anyway, when Lenny showed up, it was quite a scene, because he had one of his high school friends drive him there in a black Monte Carlo with dark tinted windows. The door opened, and Lenny stepped out smoking a cigarette and holding a beer. In the floor of the car was a bicycle chain and some brass knuckles and a short baseball bat and some other stuff, so the guys all said, "Ooh," and "Ah," and began to get nervous about what might be about to happen. Then Lenny made a big show out of putting on a pair of tight-fitting black leather gloves and laying out all of his weapons, including an old brown beer bottle. Lenny said, "Your choice of weapons." And Billy Tucker just looked a little impatient and said, "Suit yourself, I'm good to go." So Lenny slipped the brass knuckles over his gloves and then began to close in on Billy, who promptly grabbed his arm and slung him to the ground and then did a belly flop on top of him. Suddenly we couldn't see Lenny anymore. We could hear him a little, so we knew he was under there somewhere, but he was all crumpled up like a mosquito. Most of the noises coming out from under Billy were muffled cuss words and, "Get off of me! Get off of me!" But Billy didn't get off until Lenny said, "I give up." When Billy Tucker got off the ground, his face was flushed. And when Lenny Hardesty got up, his face was flushed too. I don't remember what the fight was about. 8th grade was like 7th grade, but different. For one thing, Zach Masterson was always in love with someone, usually Connie Plagman. Sometimes when we were walking somewhere, Zach would start singing a radio song, except that he would change the words to be about Connie Plagman, which was funny because Connie didn't like him and Zach couldn't sing very well. He'd sing all sincere and dreamlike with a faraway look in his eyes, which I realize now was mostly hormones. Some people are in love with being in love. Barry Maxwell was definitely not one of those people. But Barry never gave Zach a hard time about Connie Plagman or anything because Zach Masterson was not just a good boxer, he was unbelievable good. Muhammad Ali good. And absolutely fearless. But somehow, deep inside, we all knew that Barry could probably just Billy Tucker Zach's ass so no one ever let it get started. It was when I was in 8th grade that my mom started dating for the first time since she was 16. Steve was an assistant manager at one of those steakhouses where you push a tray and pay for your steak up front and then wait for them to call your number. Looking back, I wish I had been less of a jerk towards Steve because he was really a pretty good guy. But when you're 13 years old, no one is good enough to date your mother. So I was never very nice to him, even though he tried hard to make me like him. Steve's dream was to drive an 18-wheeler, so my mom encouraged him to pursue his dream and go to truck driving school. They dated for about a year and a half, and then he found a financial backer who was willing to set him up in his own restaurant in Kansas City, so he asked my mom to marry him, and we'd all move to Kansas City. Mom thought about it for a few days and then told him no, that she had a good job at Shell Oil Company and a nice house with an FHA 221-D2 loan, and a son and a daughter who had friends in Broken Arrow. 8th grade was when I had the perfect pair of shoes. They were Converse All-Stars, which are canvas and high-top. And since it's not cool to ride a bicycle in the 8th grade, I walked in them so much that the rubber soles were worn so thin that I could step on a dime and tell you if it was heads or tails. It was like wearing moccasins, which I also wore sometimes. One night in particular, I was glad to be wearing the All-Stars with the paper-thin soles. It was Halloween, and Zach and Barry and me were looking for mischief when mischief found us instead. We were walking down a side street when a car with a loud muffler pulled up alongside us, and all four doors exploded open and 27 guys leaped out shouting, "Get him, get him, get him!" And the M they were talking about was us. You'd be surprised how fast you can run when you're basically barefoot and everyone else is wearing shoes. Mitch Phillips and Carl Adney were in the 9th grade at Sequoia Junior High, which means they were 1 year older than us. They had that muscular alpha male thing going on like Dexter Kingsley, except that Dexter was muscular and vain and funny. Mitch and Carl were muscular and vain and mean. In other words, they would deliberately hit you in the face with a basketball and then say, "Sorry, it slipped," and walk away laughing. At night in the 8th grade, you stand under the streetlight on the corner and talk about things that seemed important at the time, but that no one can remember anymore. Eleanor Metzger lived one block away so that I could stand on the back porch of my house and she could stand on the front porch of her house, and we could see each other across the three backyards that were between us. We used to do that a lot at night, but she was never my girlfriend. One night during the summer before 9th grade, we were looking at our 8th grade yearbooks together over the phone, turning the pages and making comments about the people on each page when I saw a girl that I had never seen before. "Who is this Penny Collier?" I asked. Eleanor said that she had a couple of classes with Penny and that she was nice. "I'm going to marry that girl," I said, which was funny because I had never said that about a girl before and I never said it again. When we started back to school, we were 9th graders, and Zach Masterson was at Subiaco Academy in Arkansas, which meant that now it's pretty much just Barry and me. Penny Collier was in my homeroom class, which was civics, taught by Coach Marks in one of the portable buildings outside. So on open house night, Penny's mom and dad came with her to that room. Mr. Collier was a stern-looking man, but since I had decided to marry his daughter, I felt I should introduce myself, which was almost as scary as looking into an ocean of Vitalis in the Munn's bathroom pantry. But now Penny Collier at least knew my name. In February, the 9th grade girls host a school-wide thing called the Sweetheart Banquet, which is really just a dress-up party in the cafeteria where the girls invite the boys instead of the boys inviting the girls. Penny asked me to be her date, and I still have pictures of her in a pink and white formal gown with me in a pink and white tuxedo. I had a motorcycle back then because in Oklahoma you could get a motorcycle license when you were just 14 years old. But my mom's boyfriend drove us in his car. Penny and I remained friends for the next 2 years, but we were really never boyfriend and girlfriend or anything like that. Toward the end of that year, Barry Maxwell turned 16 and got his driver's license because he was 15 months older than me. Barry's grandmother bought him a brand new 1972 Mustang, so we spent most of our time on the road. His grandmother also had an old two-story house in Muskogee, which was only about an hour away, and the whole upper floor was ours. It was from the upstairs of Barry's grandmother's house that he and I plotted our takeover of the world. Summer came and summer went, and then it was time for high school to start, which is definitely a whole other thing. One day, Cliff Saunders called to ask me if I wanted to help him pick up trash from the fields surrounding the new Oil Coolers of America factory at the edge of town. He said that we'd make minimum wage, which was $3.35 an hour, and since I needed the money, I immediately agreed to help. It turns out that one of the owners was Church of Christ, which is how Cliff got the job. I didn't attend very much anymore, but most of the people still considered me to be one of them, which caused a lot more problems than you might think. Church of Christ people tend to be tolerant of your weaknesses and opinions, as long as your weaknesses and opinions are the same as theirs, and then it's biblical and all. But God help you if you have a weakness in an area where they have a fixation, or an opinion where they have an obsession. But I would never say that or anything. Anyway, we did such a good job picking up trash that they offered Cliff and me a job on the night shift cutting fin tubes. If you've ever seen any kind of cooling unit, you've seen fin tubes. They're basically metal tubes with razor-sharp aluminum fins for transferring the heat from whatever liquid is flowing inside. And then there's a fan on the other side pulling air through the fin tubes, so it's kind of a giant radiator for hot crude oil and natural gas, except that the fan blades are about 8 feet long. The metal shop where we worked was loud and dangerous since our chop saw used friction blades, which exploded a lot. They spun at 14,000 RPM, so I always stood a little to the side so the blades wouldn't rip into my guts when they exploded like what happened to Richard Blankenship, who was transferred to the purchasing office when he got out of intensive care. We worked most nights until about 10 p.m. and then on Saturdays from 6 a.m. till noon. I was still working there when I got married. When you're a sophomore at Broken Arrow High School, you can enroll in athletics and get out of school an hour early so that you can go to practice. This would be a really good thing, except that they expect you to play a sport. So each spring, Cliff Saunders and I would try out for the tennis team, and then about 3 weeks into it, when everyone competed to see who was going to be on the traveling team, we'd both make sure that we lost the critical match and got cut from the team. I'm not sure what we'd have done if Cliff and I ever had to play each other, but that never happened, and there's no rule that says you've got to be good enough to make the team, so we both got credit for athletics each year by whacking a tennis ball around on the court for about 3 weeks in the spring. When I was in grade school, I was knee-deep in guys named Tommy. But at Oil Coolers of America, it was guys named Dale. The first one was the son of the owner's secretary, but he went to high school in a neighboring town, so Cliff and I didn't know him. On the day that he was introduced to us as the newest of the schoolboys, Cliff took one look at his olive complexion and said, "What are you, some kind of Puerto Rican or something?" Cliff Saunders was racist, which everyone knows is stupid unless they're a racist too. Dale answered, "No, I ain't no Rican." But Cliff never called him anything but Rican after that, and pretty soon the nickname stuck, so now we were down to just four Dales. First, there was the Dale Ackerson, who paid a dollar to see me eat a giant jalapeno pepper in just one bite. He also sold me his 68 Cougar for just $150 after he wrecked it. Then there was Dale Montgomery, who was 325 pounds and worked part-time as a bail bondsman's helper. Then there was Dale, the uptight shop foreman, who never figured out that Cliff and I had a key to the supply cabinet. We had it made by a locksmith after getting the serial number off the bottom of his precious padlock, so we could get supplies whenever we needed them. And last was Dale the Big Irishman, who lifted me off my feet with an uppercut to the jaw when I was 16 and just 155 pounds, and he was 32 and 240. It happened when I objected to him stealing my cheeseburger. But I got even with the Irishman in a way that changed his life forever. Cliff's name for me was Dean, but I never knew why. My mom started dating a new guy named Gene, who was an expert auto mechanic and could throw a knife and stick it from across the room, which I saw him do more than once. Gene helped me fix up the Cougar I bought from Dale Ackerson, and him and me spent a lot of time together, but I don't think my mom ever felt left out or anything. Auctions were another thing Gene taught me about. I would go with him to estate auctions, where he would buy stuff that was underpriced and then sell it later for a lot more money. At the end of every auction, people would wander around with a dazed look in their eye because they were just beginning to realize how much stuff they had bought, and now it was time to get it all home. I made a lot of money hauling stuff for people who drove sports cars to auctions. I had a 1948 3/4-ton GMC pickup, the one with the curved windows in the back corners of the cab that everybody wants. Gene had a 1960 Ford station wagon with an iron rack built on top and Boondocker tires on white spoked rims. So between the two of us, we could haul the contents of an entire 3-bedroom apartment if there was at least one mattress we could lay across the top to help tie everything down. And that includes all major household appliances. More than once, I had to unstack a few layers off the top so Gene could get under a low-hanging telephone wire. I think our record was 15 feet 3 inches. But there was no such thing as making two trips because Gene had too much pride. Before I bought the Cougar from Dale Ackerson, I rode to school and to work every day with Cliff Saunders, whose dad had given him a brand new olive green Vega wagon with an automatic transmission and a 4-cylinder engine about the size of a loaf of bread. When a traffic light turned green, the Vega didn't have enough acceleration to make it to the other side of the intersection before it turned yellow again. When Cliff stomped the accelerator, the car didn't go any faster, it just made a different noise. Sometimes I'd say, "Make it make that noise, Cliff." And he'd stomp the pedal and nothing would change except for the sound of the motor, and we'd both laugh until we couldn't see. But Cliff got me back when I bought my Cougar. Whenever I was driving outside of Broken Arrow, he'd wait until we were alongside a carload of mean-looking thugs, and then he'd yell at them and give them the finger. Of course, they would always start chasing us, but Cliff knew there was no way I'd ever let them catch us. The worst that could happen was that I would get a ticket for speeding or reckless driving or endangering human life or something, and that was perfectly okay with Cliff. The guys with the coolest car were the twins, Rod and Todd, whose dad bought them a new star-skinned Hutch Gran Torino, red with a big white C stripe that swept from the roof to the headlights. Very 70s. Then he traded the Gran Torino for a metallic brown Corvette. Earth tones were also big in the 1970s. I was glad when that decade ended. We had an open campus at Broken Arrow High, which means you could go out to lunch instead of eating in the cafeteria. So my friends and I always went to Fred's Drive-In, where the back room was reserved especially for us. Fred had a menu that included every edible item you've ever heard of, and several more you didn't even know you could eat. And every day as we walked in, Fred would hand our meals over the half door as we filed past. All this happened in a matter of seconds. It was really an amazing thing. And as we walked out the door each day, we'd call out what we wanted the next day, and Fred would always have whatever we shouted, even when we all talked at once. Fred never made a mistake. Once, someone told me he wasn't even the original Fred, that his real name was Buford or something, and that he had bought the drive-in and kept the name. But he made us feel like we belonged. So we always slapped down whatever amount of money he named. Mrs. Birdsong was from the Deep South. She talked even slower than we did. She was an excellent algebra teacher, though, not like that mechanical wind-up toy Mr. Felix that I had for geometry the following year. I had been in Mrs. Birdsong's class for only a few weeks when she began to wonder if I was cheating. I never showed how I came up with the answers on the test, I'd just write them down. So one day before class started, she walked back to my desk and read several word problems to me from a book. They mostly had to do with airplanes flying in different directions at different speeds, how far apart they would be in so many minutes and things like that. Every time I gave her the answer, she would just smile and read me another question. Finally, the bell rang and she closed her book and said, "You've the gift of intuitive reasoning. You're a very fortunate boy." Mrs. Birdsong gave me A's and we never had a problem. The following year, Mr. Felix announced on the first day of class that he would be assigning us an hour's homework every night and picking it up the next day, but that 4 out of 5 days, he'd throw all the papers away without ever looking at them. But one day each week, he would actually grade the homework papers, and our final semester grade would be the composite of our homework grades averaged with our weekly test grades. He then stood very erect and challenged us by saying, "If you think you're smart enough to figure out which days I'm going to grade the homework and turn it in only on those days, then go right ahead. But I warn you that I myself don't know in advance which days I'll grade." The concept of meaningless labor seemed grossly unfair to me, especially since Mr. Felix had such a smug, authoritarian Barney Fife attitude. So I raised my hand and said, "If it's not important enough to you to even look at, then why should it be important enough to me to spend an hour doing it?" This made Mr. Felix very angry, and he said that as punishment, I was going to have to do 2 hours homework. I said that was perfectly okay with me, since not doing 2 hours homework was just as easy as not doing 1 hour. You don't have to be a math whiz to know that 98s and 100s on each week's geometry test, averaged with a 0 for each week's geometry homework, brought my overall score down to 49.5, which everyone knows is failing. But it really hit the fan when the results of the whoop-de-doo nationally standardized test came in, and the school counselors wanted to know how I could be in the top percentile in every subject, yet carry a grade average in the bottom one-third of my class. That's when they noticed my geometry test scores compared to my final grade, that I flunked driver's education because I wouldn't color the coloring books the coaches gave us, and other things like that. But I had gotten all A's in chemistry and biology and other classes that were taught by actual teachers. Finally, they decided it would just be easier to change my F's to D's so that I could graduate instead of explaining to the school board how a kid who gets an A on every test can still flunk out of school. I once used similar logic to convince a foaming-at-the-mouth policeman to let me out of jail. It all started when Rod and Todd suggested that we race back to the high school from Fred's drive-in. This was obviously a stupid thing to do, but when you're 17, you're stupid sometimes. So I agreed, and they took off in their Corvette before I even got into my car. By the time I got the Cougar started, Rod and Todd were halfway to the traffic light at Elm Street, which turned red before they could get there. When they were forced to stop, I took this God-given opportunity to swerve into the parking lot beside them and shoot across it at a high rate of speed. When I shot off a curb onto Elm Street about 100 feet ahead of a police cruiser which was returning from Highway Patrol headquarters, it was not a good thing at all. It seems the morning dispatcher at Highway Patrol headquarters in Tulsa was also the afternoon dispatcher for the Broken Arrow Police Department, so when the officer gave me lights and siren, I pulled into the parking lot of a gas station where I was followed by a bunch of other cars full of students who wanted to see what would happen. Under normal circumstances, this wouldn't have been a big problem. You just get out of the car and give the officer your driver's license without saying a word. But these weren't normal circumstances, because the dispatcher he was transporting was an attractive young woman, and the policeman was extremely short and had obviously been mad about it all his life. So when I offered him my driver's license, he slapped it out of my hand and did his best to touch his nose to my nose as he yelled like a Marine drill sergeant, "Where did you get that, TG&Y?" which everyone knows is a dime store if you grew up in Oklahoma. Then he opened the back door of the police car and yelled, "Pick that up and get into that car." So I quietly told him that although I was happy to pick up the license, I would prefer not to go anywhere with him until he calmed down a little bit. I bent down to pick up the driver's license, and when I stood up, he grabbed me by the hair and put his knee in my back. Looking back on it, I think he was trying to bend me over backwards or do some fancy cop move he saw on a TV show. But when I spun around, he fell on his backside and went absolutely cross-eyed crazy and started flailing around like a turtle that someone had turned onto his back. I glanced at the lady dispatcher in the front seat of the patrol car, and she was bawling and screaming hysterically, and I looked at my friends who were standing 25 or 30 feet away, shouting, "Let him cuff you or this nut's going to shoot your ass!" So when Sergeant Carter got off the pavement, I had my wrists together behind my back, and he made a big deal out of cuffing me and bouncing me off the side of the patrol car like I was resisting arrest or had said something about his mother. All the way to the station, I listened to his tirade, and then when the girl had gotten out of the car, he said, "Do you have any idea how much trouble you're in?" I quietly waited until she was out of earshot, because she was obviously the cause of his glandular problem, then answered, "No, sir. I don't know exactly what the penalty is for getting beat up by a cop in front of 24 witnesses when all you were trying to do is cooperate. Shall I give you the names of everyone who saw what happened, or should I save those for the judge?" After thinking about it for a few seconds, he drove me back to my car. I think maybe the absolute stupidest thing I ever did was agree to go to a party in the country with Rod and Todd and Kevin Hocutt. None of us had ever been drunk before, so we all chipped in, and Rod bought 2 quarts of Montezuma Aztec Gold tequila. We were worried that it wouldn't be enough. When we arrived at the party, we all jumped into Kevin's cargo van and sat in a circle on the floor, and Rod opened one of the bottles of tequila. Each of us took a sip and made a face, and then Todd got out a pencil and marked a place on the label and said he was going to chug the tequila down to that mark. The pencil and the bottle went from hand to hand for about 4 minutes, which was enough time for us to nearly empty the quart. Finally, Todd said, "How much of this stuff do you have to drink before it starts to take effect?" I answered, "I don't know, but this is boring as hell, and tequila tastes like drain opener." Todd replied, "Let's go outside and see what's going on." Since all of us had been sitting quietly in a circle and not moving around very much during the 4 or 5 minutes that we had been chugging tequila, our blood hadn't quite pumped all the devilment up to our brains. But that changed when Todd turned around to open the sliding door on the cargo van. Whew! Todd began to reel and grab at the air. "I think it's beginning to take effect." Finally, Todd got the door open, and when he stepped out of the van, he fell in the gravel driveway. That's just sad, I thought, as I sat quietly in the van. Todd wants everyone to think he's drunk. Todd then saw a big St. Bernard barking at him from across the yard, so he began to chase it, but the dog stayed about 10 feet ahead of him. Occasionally, he'd turn his big St. Bernard head and woof at him. All this happened in only 30 seconds or less, so after I had put the top back on the bottle, I started moving toward the door of the van. I remember steadying myself a little against the door frame before stepping out of the van, but when I put my foot outside, it never made it to the ground, but curled up under the van. The first thing to touch the parking lot was my face. When I raised my head, I remember being vaguely aware that I had gravel stuck to my cheek. But then I saw Todd dive for the St. Bernard and thought, Todd needs help if he's ever going to catch that St. Bernard. I have no memory after that. I woke up in my bed in my clothes, which were covered in vomit, and my car was not in the driveway. At first I was afraid I was going to die, and then I was afraid I wouldn't. Who knew that a human being could be this sick and live? All through high school, Penny Collier was like my sister. Most evenings I went to her house and had dinner with her family. When neither of us had a date, we'd go running around together, usually about 5 nights a week. Then one day, during our senior year, I realized I was in love with her and couldn't possibly imagine not seeing her every night. We began to talk about getting married. We were 17 years old. One Sunday afternoon, my mom called Penny's house to tell me that Pearl was acting funny. She seems a little bit weak and tired. Maybe you should come home. All the way there, I was thinking, I've been so inconsiderate of her age. After all, she's about 1,000,001 years old in dog years. So I stopped and bought her several cans of expensive dog food and vitamins and everything else I could grab I thought she might like, and when I got home and she saw me, she immediately got up and wearily walked over to me. When I saw how tired she was, I tracked down a veterinarian at his home, and he agreed to examine her, so Pearl and I met him at his office a few minutes later. After a series of tests, Dr. Gabriel told me that Pearl's kidneys had quit functioning and her bloodstream was slowly being poisoned with impurities as a result. Is there anything that can be done? No, I'm sorry. I wasn't able to speak for several minutes, and I couldn't see very well either. So Pearl did what she always did when she knew I was feeling sad. But at least she's feeling no pain, said Dr. Gabriel. She's just feeling a little tired, that's all. How long does she have? I asked. Only about 24 hours. On April 28, 1994, a politically liberal radio host named William O'Shaughnessy commented on the death of Richard Nixon. O'Shaughnessy's audience expected him to use the opportunity to lecture them about evil conservative Republicans, but the unpredictable liberal surprised them by saying, Richard M. Nixon, the senior statesman of our American nation, died last Friday evening. A hospital bulletin, which went out to all the world, noted that the former president left this life with his family at his bedside. But as dying is something you have to do all by yourself, Mr. Nixon's departure was quite in keeping with the way he lived. He was always alone. You see, I am an expert on all this because Nixon and I went to the same dentist. He got drilled and x-rayed just as I did, in the same chair. So I can get on the radio and tell you all about his place in history. In this endeavor, I am being monitored and closely watched by faithful listeners who have been asking, just what will you say about Nixon on the local radio? I mean, given your history and all. Well, here it is. I liked the son of a bitch. I think we've lost a great man. And I don't feel compelled to apologize for feeling the way I do about the flawed, imperfect, awkward, struggling man who was buried yesterday. Now, maybe you're going to think that this is sacrilege or blasphemy or something, but I believe that Jesus feels the same way toward you and me that William O'Shaughnessy felt toward Richard Nixon. Nixon didn't ever do anything to earn O'Shaughnessy's approval, but O'Shaughnessy chose to like him anyway. And then, when Nixon was dead and gone, O'Shaughnessy stood up to defend him and say, yeah, he may have been a screwed-up mess, but I liked him anyway. Now, maybe you think I'm crazy, or that it was all just a simple coincidence. But I believe that Jesus hears the prayers of flawed, imperfect, awkward, struggling 8-year-old boys, and remembers them long after they themselves have forgotten. As I think about all the things I told you about, and 100 others I didn't, it occurs to me that perhaps I was a borderline juvenile delinquent. But that's the whole point of the story. You can't judge the future by the present. And there's always more going on inside a person than you can tell by looking. Who would have predicted that the kid who graduated in the bottom third of his class would receive a knighthood and an honorary PhD and write a series of best-selling books? So why? Please tell me why. 38 years later, in the middle of the night, I'm thinking about my best friend Pearl, and Benny and Dexter and Zach and Barry and all the Tommies and Dales and Ophelia Pinkerton and Dink the Pony and Sundown in Muskogee. Which brings me back to where I am. In bed with my wife Penny, who is fast asleep, at 4:10 in the morning.